Last week we were having a Bible study on confession, and we were talking a little bit about confession of a variety of sorts, and I talked about the fifth step, which is, as you can see, confession to God, self, and another person, the exact nature of my wrongs. The Bible study leader was telling this story about a young friend of his who went to confession as a Catholic every Saturday morning. And when this boy would ask him why he always went to confession, the answer was, because it will keep me out of hell. Going to confession every Saturday will keep me out of hell. Well, Robert, who is the registrar here, was at this Bible study, and he said, you know, I've been thinking about this. He says this in his beautiful Scottish brogue. That the kind of confession the boy was talking about kept him out of hell. The kind of confession you're talking about, the fifth step, gets one out of hell. It gets you out of your own hell. And I think that's really a very interesting observation. I want to begin with a couple of stories. When one of our sons was 4 years old, he threw a ball. Hi, welcome. Come on in. Hi. He threw a ball and broke a vase. We knew that he had broken the vase. I don't know if he knew that we knew he had broken the vase. But when we would ask him, he would insist that his little brother or sister had done it, or that the dog had done it, or that demons from outside somewhere had done it. You know, never was his own fault. And we watched for several days, feeling very powerless as his relationship to us deteriorated. He became naughtier and naughtier and more and more distant. And then finally one night he came with a tear-streaked face, and he sobbed to us, "Mom and Dad, it was me. I broke the vase." And we were able to take him in our arms and hold him and love him and forgive him. On the other hand, when I was four, I was riding my trike around in the basement, and we had one of those wooden clothes rack things. Do you know what I mean? And they're sort of wobbly things anyway. And I was whipping along on my trike, and I notched the leg of this thing with the wheel, back wheel of my trike, and broke it off. And it tumbled. And all the clothes went whoosh to the floor. And of course, I was terrified. And so I just went upstairs and didn't say a word to anybody. My mother came down and right away asked who had done it. And nobody, of course, would admit to having done it. And then she asked me specifically, "Did you do it?" Of course, I said no. And she asked again, and then I couldn't say yes because I would have to confess then both to breaking the wooden rack and to lying. So I doubled my stakes in this whole thing. I never did tell her. I never did have a chance to receive from her that forgiveness. And I just shoved it down into my mind, and it was one of those kind of funny things that bubbled up when I was doing my own fifth step 40 years later. 40 years, that guilt for breaking this wooden clothes rack and lying to my mother sat inside of me. Guilt is a real killer. It's like carrying around an ever-growing bag of rocks hanging from your neck. Or it's like having an attic in a basement filled with poisonous snakes and spiders just sitting there waiting to get you. Or maybe it's like wearing a choke collar. How many of you have tried to discipline a dog with a choke collar? And every guilt pulls that collar a little tighter and a little tighter and a little tighter. And finally, all of your life force, all of that wonderful energy with which we all can live is choked off. No matter how far down we have pushed our guilts into our subconscious, they still sit there, and they tell us that we have failed, that we're no good, and that we deserve to be punished. Yesterday we were talking about the fourth step, which is a fearless moral inventory, and it's a kind of a peeling back of self. And we go through all the masks and the defenses and try to get at what really is at our core, what really is at our foundation. And in the process of doing the fourth step, and some of you took that inventory, and maybe some of you even took it seriously and looked at yourself, we likely come across many aspects of ourselves that we don't like very much. We may have seen how our judgmental attitudes toward others have diminished other people. We may have seen how our anger or our temper has controlled others, how our low self-esteem has made us unable to respond to the call of God. We probably discovered certain negative patterns in our behavior, patterns that control us, that work against our being able to live in the image of God, the image of a God energized by love and love manifested in all that God does. And it is in that image that we are created. We may now realize how many of the traits we thought were good about us, like caretaking or like being religious or like being responsible, also have their dark side, and that we have hurt those around us by being locked into a particular way of being and into a particular way of approaching the world. Samuel Johnson has said that unless we have courage, we have no security for preserving any other virtue. Unless we have courage, we have no security for preserving any other virtue. And someone else has said, I think it's in the big book, that the 12 steps is for the brave. The 12 steps is for the brave. This is true of all of the steps, I think, but it seems, at least at first, to be particularly true of the fifth step. This step is confession to God and to self and to another person the exact nature of my wrongs. It's sitting down with another person for maybe 2 or 3 hours, going through your life and placing a moral value on what you've done. I hurt my mother. I hurt my sister. I hurt myself. I hurt all of these people in my life. It involves the big things, you know, those big skeletons that we push into our closets and just leave there. And it involves all the little things, the common, ordinary things, the put-downs, the resentments, the grudges. And I call those little things, but they really aren't. They're not little things at all. They eat us up from the inside out. Why does the fifth step insist that we confess to God, to self, and to another person? Well, first let's take a look at God. Surely God knows more about us than we'll ever know about ourselves. There's a wonderful verse in Psalms that says, please forgive me for the sins I don't know enough to even confess. You know. But think back to the story of our son. As long as he held on to his lie about the vase, something was askew in his relationship to us. He couldn't accept our abundant love for him as long as that lie was sitting inside of him, making him feel unworthy of that love. And it's the same way with us and God, that as long as we hold on to our guilt and don't confess it to God, somehow we feel we are unworthy of God's love, and we can't accept it with the kind of abandon that we could if we didn't have that guilt. So we tell God, not for God's sake, but for ours, so that we can once again accept God's love. Why do we have to confess to ourselves? Why do we have to name these things? Why do we have to say them? Why do we have to put words on them? I'm a teacher of writing, and one of the things that I've discovered over the years is that there's an incredibly generative power in language. That when people start writing, when people start putting things down on paper and then seeing what they've said, something happens and something new is created. There's a generative power to language. So you can have a nagging feeling about guilt, about a variety of things. But when you say in words that you can hear, and you put language onto it, I lied to my mother. I mercilessly teased my sister. I cheated on tests. Whatever it is that we've done, all that junk that we have sitting inside of us, when you put language on it, then something happens. something very important happens. It brings you to a point of great humility. And that's a good place, I think, for a lot of us to be. But it also diffuses the power of those guilts to choke off our lives. It diffuses their power when we can name them. The question that is most often asked is, why does another person have to be present? Why can't I go into a church and sit down with my list and just run through it, say it, be done with it? Why do I have to risk telling another person? What if that person doesn't keep my confidence? What if that person goes, oh, you did? You know? What if that person in some way condemns me? What if, what if, what if? And we do all of these kinds of what ifs to ourselves. Why does another person have to be present? There are a lot of reasons why the fifth step involves another person. But two most important ones, I think. First of all of our wrongs have been played out in the arena of public life. That we don't live on an island. That whatever we are and whatever we do affects other people. And so that one person, in a sense, represents all persons. We confess to one person, but we are, in a sense, confessing to all those whom we have lived with and whom we have hurt. And the specific dealing with those persons comes later on in the step, so it's not like you're off the hook in relationship to those people. But, in fact, this person does represent all other people. And from that person we receive acceptance and forgiveness. That person represents both God and others. That person ushers us into a new way of relating to others based on trust, on honesty, and on vulnerability. Through the fifth step, we can begin to accept and to love ourselves because we know that both God and another person know us, know all there is to know about us, at least all that we know about ourselves. And they accept us just as we are. It's a wonderful, wonderful freeing thing. The final phrase talks about the exact nature of my wrongs. What does that mean? Well, it means that as we begin recounting the various ways in which we have hurt others and ourselves, and trying to be totally honest about our motivations, we discover usually certain patterns. Certain character defects or cracks in our foundation from which most of these other things sort of flow. And we find out something about our particular nature, the exact nature of these wrongs. For some of us, and we looked at this in relationship to the fourth step, for some of us it's a certain pride or an arrogance toward the world. For some of us it's a self-absorption. For some of us it's resentment and jealousy and that sort of thing. For some of us, it's thinking far more poorly of ourselves than we should. And we're cheating ourselves and we're cheating the world of what we could be when we think too poorly of ourselves. So doing a fifth step helps us to figure out what those things are and to name them. For about 2 years, I had the privilege of working as a volunteer fifth stepper at a treatment center in town for women. And maybe twice a week or so, I would go out there and sit for 2 or 3 hours with a woman who had reached probably the lowest point of her life. I would listen to the very painful admissions of all that these people had done. Some of the stories, especially in the last year that I was there, when most of the people were either cocaine or crack addicts, were incredibly painful stories. People who had, there were deaths involved in almost all of them. People who had killed their own children while they were high on crack, or who had been a part of gang murders, who had done all sorts of horrible things. And my only purpose there was to radiate to them God's unconditional acceptance and love. Incredibly powerful experience. When I would sit with them, they had usually, the day before or a couple of days before, talked about their life from a chronological point of view to the whole community. They would have to read their life story to the community. So when we came to the fifth step, what I would have them do, instead of walking through their life chronologically, It was to walk through their life relationship by relationship and talk about the ways that they had hurt these people. And a lot of these people had hurt them in very dramatic ways. But we didn't talk about that. We talk about ways that they had hurt these people. And I would always tell them to pick a parent, and they would usually start with the most problematic parent, of course. And that's where we would go, and we'd go through siblings and friends and teachers and employers and kids and husbands and multiple kinds of people in their lives. And then they would say, well, that's all. That's all the people in my life. And then I would say, no, we have one more person, the most important person of all. Let's start talking now about the ways that you've hurt yourself. And so we would walk through the various aspects of their lives and look at how they had in fact hurt themselves. And most of the pain that people inflict upon themselves has to do with the whole problem of forgiveness. And so I want to focus on that a little bit right now, because I think it's something that we all can take a good, strong look at. Most of these women were absolutely unable to forgive themselves for what they had done. And they were also unable to forgive others. They were unable to forgive the father that raped them, or the fraternity boys that gang raped them, or, you know, all of these horrible things that had happened to them, and they were unable to forgive. And so we would talk about that, and we would talk about the ways in which that holding on to that anger and that pain, being an unforgiving person of both self and others, was affecting them and was hurting them. I ran across a book in the library that I would really like to recommend to you. It's called Learning to Forgive. And she details several things that happen to people when they don't forgive. And I want to talk about some of her ideas and comment on them a little bit. First of all, she says that when people don't forgive, they are led by their anger, their pain, or their hatred. Now, we've been talking all week about how if we are going to be living in God's image, it is the image of God as energized by love. But a person who can't forgive is not energized by love. That person is energized by anger or by hatred to another or of self, or by the pain that has happened to them. Those are their energizing forces. And so we are diminished in our ability to live as people created in the image of God when we cannot forgive either ourselves or others. She also says that when people don't forgive, they're directed by negative memories. They're directed by negative memories. The past has a strong hold on them. I did a fifth step with a woman a few years ago whose mother had been incredibly unloving toward her. And in fact, her mother didn't want her. And this woman had found a diary that her mother had written while she was in the hospital having her, in which she had said, I don't want this child. I don't love her. I wish I didn't have her. And this woman had been just absolutely caught in the pain of that all of her life. She read it when she was about 7 years old. And she spent her whole life trying to garner from this woman the love that she felt that she didn't have, and also being incredibly angry because she had not been given what is our birthright, the love of a parent. And so this memory was directing her whole life. It had control of her. In the process of doing the fifth step, we walked back into that memory and brought Christ into that memory and let Christ do the healing. And she was released from the pain of that memory, and the wonderful new relationship with her mother was established, which is just quite miraculous. And those are the things that can happen as a result of a fifth step. When people don't forgive, they keep a controlling grasp on situations and people. They have a way of always keeping a hook in people when they don't forgive them. You know, you owe me something. You failed me, and therefore you owe me something. We jokingly tell our son that the one that is the recovering addict, that we're going to live with him in our old age as a way of punishing him for all that we went through with him. And it is a joke now. But I think for a while it wasn't really a joke. It was our way of hooking him, trying to make him feel guilty for what he had put us through by telling us he was going to have to take care of us when I'm old and have Alzheimer's and giving people all kinds of trouble. Whenever you don't forgive somebody totally, you keep a hook in them. Whenever you don't forgive yourself, you keep a hook in yourself. It's a crazy thing. We talk about the second step, which is insane behavior. It's a crazy thing to keep these hooks in ourselves. But we do it. We do it all the time. When people don't forgive, they do something to their bodies. And it's really a sad, sad thing. We are all cut of one cloth. And our bodies tend to work out whatever it is that our minds and our spirits are dealing with. So people who are led by anger, who are controlled by hatred, who are wallowing in their own pain, who are filled with grudges and resentment, who can't forgive themselves and can't forgive other people, do awful things to their bodies. Their blood pressures go up, their intestinal system will often go. All kinds of physiological things. We live with stress and with tension. We likely shorten our lives, and maybe by quite a lot, when we live with that kind of stuff inside of us. It does bad things to our bodies. And that's one of the reasons why we've been given forgiveness, so we don't need to do that. We don't need to do that. When people don't forgive, their relationship with God is weakened. In the Lord's Prayer, it says that forgive us our sins as we forgive those who have sinned against us. And I like to think of forgiveness as sort of a flow, like water, like these streams that are running out here. And if we stop it up, if we say, okay, I'll take your forgiveness, God, but I'm not going to pass it on. What happens? What happens when you stop up water? It backs up, the pools get stagnant, rotten, right? Okay. So forgiveness is like that. Love is also like that. You know, unless you stay open, unless you let it run through you to others, it backs up and it starts to do bad things to you. You can't keep accepting God's love, you can't keep accepting God's forgiveness, unless that is rushing right out of you to everybody with which you associate. And of course, finally, and this is almost too obvious to talk about, whenever we don't forgive another, our relationships with everybody are weakened. She talks about the snip school of handling relationships, where whenever anybody hurts you, you kind of cut them out of your life, you know? And once you've done that a time or two, other people see it. Other friends become aware that that's the way you respond whenever you're hurt. And they become very tentative and very frightened. They don't want to be your friend. Because a friend is someone you have to be able to trust that if you hurt them, they will forgive you. And so your inability to forgive one person alters your relationships to all other people. And it also controls you in another way. And I think of the work of Elie Wiesel. I don't know if you people know of his writing. Incredible Holocaust survivor and writer. And this man who saw his family killed in the concentration camps, who would have every right to live a life of anger, of resentment, of hate, of rage. He would have every right to live that way. And yet his comment was, if the enemy robs us of our joy, then the enemy has won. The enemy robs us of our ability to experience joy, then the enemy has won. And if you cannot forgive the enemy, then the enemy robs you of the ability to feel joy. Because what's inside of you? Hate and anger and resentment. And then the enemy wins. So the hurt begins at one point, and it continues, and it continues, and it continues, and it continues. And we really do a great disservice to ourselves. I was asked a year or so ago to write some quotable quotations that Hazelden was going to put together a book of, one of these notebooks with little clever sayings at the bottom, and I don't think it ever came out, at least I haven't seen it. But the one that they took of mine was, I think it was something like this, finally, forgiveness is the greatest gift we can give to ourselves because it frees us of the burdens of hate and anger and resentment. Forgiveness of both ourselves and of others is the greatest gift that we can give to ourselves. It's the greatest gift we can accept from God and then give to ourselves. I want to look again, as I've been doing all week, at the gospel, and I'm back in Luke again, which is the one I know the best. Luke 18:10 to 14. And I'm sure this is, again, a very familiar story to all of you. He also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and regarded others with contempt. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee, standing by himself, was praying thus, God, I thank you that I am not like other people, thieves, rogues, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week, I give a tenth of all my income. But the tax collector, standing far off, would not even look up to heaven, but was beating his breast and saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his home justified rather than the other. For all who exalt themselves will be humbled, but all who humble themselves will be exalted. Before doing a fifth step, I think that maybe we fear that admitting to ourselves, much less to somebody else, all the guilts from our past will fill us with such self-loathing and embarrassment that we will want to crawl into a hole and die. We will be like the publican standing there, just abject. We have, after all, spent years hiding all this stuff, both from ourselves and from other people, trying to rationalize away our guilt, building up heavy defenses so that we will be acceptable to others. We've worked so hard to create a public image that will give us the respect and love we crave. What will happen if all of that is stripped away? What happens is that we gain a totally new perspective. We see ourselves as we are, free from all the protective layers we have wrapped ourselves in. We stand naked before God, before ourselves, and before another person. And even in our nakedness, perhaps especially in our nakedness, we're beautiful, and we're acceptable, and we're loved. And the miracle that happens as a result of this kind of confession is that even as we see and accept and love ourselves, just as we are, we gain eyes that are able to see and love and accept others just as they are. We've set down at the foot of the cross that bag of heavy rocks we've been carrying around all of our lives. The poisonous snakes and the spiders have all been swept out of our basements and our attics. And that choke collar that has been cutting off our air has been taken off and allowing this rush of the breath of God into us, permeating every cell, allowing us to work and to love in a way that we never thought possible. That's what a fifth step is all about. I know that probably most of you here have had some experiences with confession, with either with yourself or with other people. And I want you to have a chance to be able to share some of those with each other. So, as we've been doing all week, why don't you get yourselves into groups of three or maybe four and talk about any experience that you've had either with somebody coming to you and confessing and a relationship being restored or with your movement out into the forgiving of somebody else. or you're the forgiving of yourself. Okay? And think about that a little bit. Try to find somebody you don't know to be in your groups. We have just a few minutes left. I'm wondering if you have things that you would like to share with the whole group. Were there any insights or threads in your stories that you think would be useful to the whole group? If you have some gem of wisdom, you don't want to keep it to yourself. Anything at all? Just scratching your hair. What we ended up talking about a lot in our group was about not changing the other person, about our absolute inability to change the other person. That even if forgiveness is a tool to change the other person, it's doomed. Mm-hmm. You know, that we do what we do for ourselves. Mm-hmm.
The more we center ourselves in Christ, the other person changes.
Well, that's, of course, the miracle stories of Al-Anon and AA. You know, that when people take care of themselves, when people start to set their own boundaries and begin to grow, the dynamic changes. I mean, when you're in a balance, in a relationship, if one part changes, the other part is going to have to change, because otherwise everything gets all skewed. So it happens, but it's not you that is changing the other person. It is you who are changing yourself. Yeah, yeah. Radar.
Yeah, in this book, to do the same thing. I was so angry.
If one didn't have the power, the other would.
Yeah. I was so bitter and so angry over the years that I couldn't find any peace at all. And then when I sobered up and came to this process of wanting to forgive, and it's like, now how do I forgive somebody when I feel so much hurt and anger towards them? And like it says here, it's forgiving them, but it's like I had to realize that by taking my responsibility of my own actions for how I reacted towards them, then I was able to free myself of that pain because I was being responsible. Nobody made me do that. I did it myself because I wanted to. And so then that helped me understand that they did what they did because that's the way they wanted to be. Mm-hmm. And that freed me of that. And then I was able to forgive them. Mm-hmm. And I was able to forgive myself. Mm-hmm. And now today I can honestly say the older I get, the smarter my dad is.
Yeah. Funny how that works, isn't it?
It is. It's real scary, but the neat part about it is the more I grow, the more I see my dad change as well. And I think that's what you were saying. Mm-hmm. So that's my own personal experience with forgiveness.
I don't want to leave you with the impression that forgiveness is easy. Or that forgiveness is a natural thing. It's probably one of the most unnatural things that we do, and we cannot do it without divine help. And we cannot do it either unless we have truly faced the pain that has been inflicted upon us, or that we've inflicted upon ourselves. We have to name it and feel it and label it and let that be. Minimizing is not the same thing as forgiving, in other words, is what I'm saying. To say, well, that really didn't hurt, that really didn't happen, that's not forgiveness. Forgiveness is acknowledging the depth of the pain, walking back into it, feeling it, and then walking out of it and saying, I don't want to live this way anymore. And the way that I cannot live this way is to let go of it, to forgive. And I do it for me. It also works for the good of the community. It works for the good of everything. But we do it for ourselves. And it's the gift that God has given us to be able to forgive. So, let's see. When do we meet again? Not till next Tuesday, I think. And we're going to go on to the sixth and seventh step, which has to do with being ready to change, being ready to have our defects of character removed. Oh, no. And why it is that we so often aren't ready, why it is that we really don't want to change, why it is that we really want to hold on to the negative parts of our behavior that